That's the Heath Brothers. Percy Heath composed Smilin' Billy Sweet. Of course, Percy Heath, the great bass player, passed away on this day in 2005, so we honor his passing with his music. We move now to what is going on in Syria and American policy with what's going on. Syria, excuse me, Ukraine. I get my countries and conflicts mixed up. With Ukraine, we're focusing on in the course of this hour, the next half an hour. We are joined by Dr. Kim Holmes, Distinguished Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, where he oversaw the think tank's defense and foreign policy team for more than two decades. Dr. John Quigley, Professor Emeritus in Law at Ohio State University. In the mid-90s, he served as an expert for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where he facilitated dialogue between government authorities of Ukraine and of Crimea on the constitutional status of Crimea, and Robert Perry, who is an investigative journalist who broke many of the Iran-Contra stories during the 80s for the Associated Press and Newsweek, author of three books, including the most recent one, Neck Deep, The Disastrous Presidency of George W. Bush. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be there.
And folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner. Your thoughts on the Ukraine and American policy towards Ukraine. 410-319-8888. And as we were preparing to go on air, I saw it came over the transom that the United States just announced penalties against Ukraine, saying that they would sanction seven Russian government officials, 17 companies with links to what they say is President Putin's inner circle, and blocking high technology sales that might contribute to Russia's military capabilities. And this was announced, and saying there'll be greater cost than that if Russia continues what they say is its provocations against Ukraine. Your thoughts, Kim Holmes? Let me start with you.
Well, it looks like what we have is this sort of a slow motion de facto invasion of eastern Ukraine by the Russians, not, of course, with their own forces directly, but with their surrogates and people they're supporting. There's already dozens of towns in eastern Ukraine that are in control of pro-Russian militias, which supported evidence shows is supported by Russian special forces. Over the weekend, the situation escalated. There was some military monitors from the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe that was taken hostage in the city of Slovyansk. A TV station was taken over by pro-Russian armed rebels. And then recently, a pro-Russian mayor of Kharkiv was shot in the back, apparently sometime either Sunday night our time. So the situation is escalating. The administration's approach is to sort of dole out the sanctions in small bits based upon what the Russians are doing. The concern I have is that the Russians are clearly in control of the escalatory ladder, if you will, and they're sort of probing to see how far the West will come together in kind of a unified response. And the problem is if we do the sanctions in small bits like this, that means that we have very little control over the situation in the long run.
Robert Perry?
About the response from the Obama
administration. Yeah, and what Kim Holmes' response to that was?
Well, we haven't seen the evidence. The problem I have as an investigative reporter is when the U.S. government makes claims and presents zero evidence of its claims, it's hard to accept it at this point. There were photographs, as I'm sure you were, Your guests remember, there were photographs that were released last week that the New York Times put on the front page that turned out to be essentially wrong. There was one key photograph that was supposedly taken in Russia showing these troops that then showed up in Ukraine, and it turned out that that photograph was taken in Ukraine, destroying the whole premise of the story. So we have a lot of propaganda, but it's going on from both sides and has to be examined very carefully.
Well, I do want to kind of – what you just raised here, Robert, I've been thinking about a lot and reading all these things going on in the Ukraine, and going back to look at the history of Crimea and the history of the Ukraine. And Dr. John Quigley, let me bring you into this. I mean, I think that this is a confusing situation, and sometimes I think we have a tendency to paint it all black and white, good guys, bad guys. But the whole thing is complex. I think that our media kind of doesn't lend itself to that complexity.
Well, let me say something. I mean, President Putin, denied that there was any Russian support for what was happening in Crimea right up until the action itself, and then he went before the Russian parliament and fully admitted it. There's been plenty of not only historical examples, but claims not just made by the United States government, but by the Ukrainians. I just don't think there's any doubt that there's Russian special forces behind this. And I know the situation is complex, but we got to remember that that's part of the Russian game plan, is to make sure that the Western response is confused and is divided, and that through that complexity, they will be able to continue the destabilization of Ukraine, which I think is their long-term goal. Well, I don't know what the end plan is. I don't know. They probably necessarily don't want to invade all of Ukraine. But they certainly don't want Ukraine to be part of the West and part of NATO. And so anything they can do to try to keep that situation open and unstable is in Russia's interest.
So I do want to get to John, but Robert, go ahead, and I'll run right to John quickly.
There's been a lot of American propaganda on this, too, and it has to be recognized. This was not a situation that Putin sought. This has become a kind of conventional wisdom in Washington that's completely historically inaccurate. Putin did not seek the confrontation in Ukraine. This was something that the U.S. was supporting, along with the Maidan demonstrators, involving, I know this is an embarrassing point, but at a key moment on February 21st, 22nd, these neo-Nazi militia groups took part in the actual overthrow of the Yanukovych government. Putin did not seek that confrontation. He did not organize the Maidan demonstrations. He did not organize those Nazi 100-man brigades that were used. It's insane to suggest that Putin was doing this. He was tied up with the Sochi Olympics at the time. He was distracted. He was not involved in trying to create this problem. He's been reacting to the problem. And we've been hearing a lot of nonsense out of Washington about this.
Well, I'm hearing words like insane and nonsense and the like. And, you know, look, I'll tell you one thing that is purely nonsense, is the idea of implying that all the Ukrainians who want to be free of Russia are somehow being tarnished as neo-Nazis.
No, he didn't say all. He said that they...
Well, he left the implication line out there.
I did not leave that
somehow that's what the movement was. If it's not the case, then we should say otherwise.
Well, aren't three of the top leaders of this new Ukrainian government part of that Nazi movement?
No.
Yes, they are.
No, good grief. I mean, this is Russian propaganda at its worst. If you want to talk about propaganda and creating the semblance of some kind of moral equivalence between the two here, is, I just think, over the top.
Well, just for the balance here, John, quickly, I'm sorry, jump in and comment on what you've been hearing.
Well, I think it is the case that the situation was not initiated by the Russian government. I mean, the Russian government was supporting Mr. Yanukovych, and then he was thrown out, and the Crimean authorities at that point demanded that Russia come in. And so even with respect to Crimea, you know, I don't think what has occurred is part of some grand Russian plan to reestablish the Soviet Union. And as for what is happening now, I think it is very unlikely that the Russian government is going to go into Ukraine in full military force, regardless of whether there are sanctions or not sanctions. Because it would be very difficult for it to control a part of eastern Ukraine. It would then have some kind of a border with the rest of Ukraine. It would have a populace that in part supports some connection to Russia, but in great part does not. So it would have a population that would be very uncertain as to its support, which is very different from the situation it now has in Crimea, where the bulk of the population is supportive of Russia.
Who was that about to say something? You?
I was getting ready to say something.
Is this Kim?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think it is correct to say that what prompted this crisis is that Putin lost his client Yanukovych in charge of Ukraine. And so, I mean, in terms of the narrative, the story of what happened and who did what first, yeah, that's what happened. And now he's got a situation on his hands where he is trying to counteract that. But the implication, therefore, that gives him the moral high ground in what he's doing in breaking up a sovereign state is, I think, a bridge way too far. And that's unfortunately, that's what happens very often when we make these excuses for what Putin is doing. I think we have to kind of step back and ask ourselves, what is it? Does international law and the sovereignty of a nation state matter? Are we going to start either inadvertently or openly supporting the argument that a state like Russia has a right to interfere in the sovereign country just because of the language? What happens to the Baltic states? What happens to Quebec? I mean, there's countries all over the place that have insurgents and secessionist movements based upon these kinds of things. If we stand for international law and the belief of sovereignty of nations, we've got a problem with this.
Can I interrupt for 1 second?
Robert Perry?
When I hear American pundits or officials talking about the sanctity of international law, it is really too much to take. The United States invaded Iraq halfway around the world, a sovereign state. We claim they had weapons of mass destruction that they didn't have.
Are you familiar with the U.N. Security Council resolution where
I am.
Unanimously
and
after
that
the
U.N.
fact
Security
that,
Council
that
resolution
the U.S.
does not well,
one
not
at a time.
For,
one at a time.
I was speaking. It does not call for, do not call for an invasion, a military invasion of Iraq.
Well, I just disagree. I mean, Resolution 1441 said that
well, actually, on radio, it's really difficult to have more than one person talking at a time. Nobody understands what anybody else is saying. Robert, let me finish what you were saying, Kim, and then I'm going to go back to John.
Well,
Robert?
The UN, the Secretary General of the UN admitted that it was illegal what the United States did with its coalition of the willing. The U.S. has recently introduced a weaponry into Syria, another sovereign state. There was a story today about the provision of TOW missiles to the Syrian rebels. The United States doesn't respect international law in any broad way. It respects it in a selective way. That's the history. That's the fact. We can't pretend otherwise.
So, Kim, and then we'll go to John.
Okay. Well, first of all, whether or not the point I was making about international law is true or not, it's completely regardless of my nationality. It either is true or isn't true. And the second, the point you're making about Iraq is that there was Resolution 1441 before that intervention that said that had the language for intervention of states that could intervene. And then after the war started, there was a resolution that sanctioned the presence of the coalition inside Iraq that was unanimously supported by the UN Security Council resolution. Now, either that is not international law or it isn't. It is or it isn't. And, here we have a sort of a perfect example of selective international law on its own.
John, let me let you in here. Then I have a very specific question about what you three have been raising. John?
Yes. That resolution with regard to Iraq did not authorize an invasion of Iraq. That's extremely clear. I mean, one can talk about different situations in which the United States itself is not respecting international law. One even more recent is the denial of a visa to Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, a very clear violation of our commitment to the United Nations. But to go specifically to the Crimea situation, even that is a bit muddled in terms of international law, because it's true that there is a prohibition against invading the territory of a sovereign nation. It's also true that peoples have a right to self-determination, which does bring into play situations like those that were being mentioned, the Quebecois or others. And it seems to me that when you do have a situation like Crimea, where you have a very clear expression of the population of secession from Ukraine, that they probably do have a right to secede. The problem is that in international law, we don't have a system to effectuate that, and that we don't have anybody at the universal level that can say, yes, you have a right to secede, therefore the other country has to let you go. I mean, if Scotland votes in favor of secession, the UK is likely to let it go. Crimea voted in favor of secession, and Ukraine is not willing to let
right.
it go.
I'm curious, though, what we think. When you read the news, watch the news, I think it's very hard for people to put their hands around what the underlying issues are and what are these interests. When you see, the government that in the Ukraine that was overthrown, That was an elected government. We may not have liked him, but Yanukovych was elected and then pushed out. The same way thing that happened to Morsi in Egypt. He was elected. People didn't like him. He was pushed out. So the question is what democracy means and what we're willing to support. That's the question I have about that. What are the interests here? What are the interests that are lining up between the Russia on the one hand, while there are troops on the one side of the border, and the Americans and European Union on the other, with their war games taking place in the Baltic at the moment and in Poland? So what are the interests here? What should Americans think about in terms of why we should care about one side or the other? What is happening, Kim?
Well, I'm concerned about the precedents being set for the Baltic states. There are significant Russian minorities inside Latvia and in Estonia. Of course, those two countries are members of NATO, and we have an Article 5 commitment to the defense of those countries. I think Putin right now has got his hands full with Ukraine, and he's not about to do anything in the near term on the Baltic states. But if you play this out in the long run, and he succeeds in establishing the principle of doing inside Ukraine in a way that is accepted by us and by the international community, then he's got a claim inside the Baltic states, too. One of the speakers a minute ago said there is no right recognized in international law these days for secession against the will of the sovereign state, except in cases where, like Sudan or something, you can make a humanitarian case that there's genocide being committed or something like that. That certainly was not the case inside Crimea, and it certainly isn't the case inside the Baltic states. So what you have here is a claim based on ethnicity, pure ethnicity. And this is, to me, a very dangerous precedent, not just for Europe, but frankly for the rest of the world.
Robert?
Well, I disagree wholeheartedly, of course, but the main point about Ukraine was that there were these demonstrations, and most of the people were there protesting. They're from Western Ukraine. They were protesting both the corruption of the Ukrainian system, not just this government, but previous governments. And some of the people in Western Ukraine did want closer ties to Europe, which was different from people in Eastern Ukraine who had more both ethnic and business and other ties toward the Russians. So you had, and they made up the majority of the population, and they were the ones who elected Yanukovych. Now, Yanukovych was targeted by these demonstrations in the Maidan. He then agreed on February 21st in a pact that was signed by three European countries that he would accept early elections to vote him out of office, a reduction of his powers, and to pull back the police from the confrontation in the Maidan. That's what led to the groups of these neo-Nazis who represented a distinct minority of these protesters, but very well organized and very aggressive. They're the ones who conducted the coup. And I talked to a person who was an international diplomat who was very much involved in what happened next, and he told me that basically with these neo-Nazis sort of running things, the international community felt a real urgency to get a new government in that would include these neo-Nazi groups in some ministries, but would not be run by them. So that was the move that happens in the latter part of February. Now, immediately, the U.S. and the EU recognized this new government, but it had violated constitutional provisions. The Ukrainian constitution provided for how to impeach a president, but they were not followed. So you had a very murky situation, a legally murky situation. Just because some countries recognize this, quote, legitimacy of this regime doesn't mean that everyone did, and the Russians certainly didn't. So then you had the Eastern Ukrainians who felt disenfranchised by this rebellion that occurred in the West, rising up to some degree, and the Crimeans demanded or sought secession from this, what they considered a coup regime. Those are the facts. Now, to then extrapolate from that situation that the Russians plan to go into Estonia, I mean, this is a sort of absurd. This is the kind of propaganda that the U.S. government has been generating over the past several weeks.
So, John wants to come in, but I know, Kim, you have a response to that. Let me go to John, then you can come right back.
Well, it's just astonishing how this is representing the Russia propaganda line. that what's happening in Ukraine is all about neo-Nazis. I just find it shocking for someone to actually fall for this. I don't know what else to say.
Well, let me go to John quickly, and I do have something to ask about that. John?
Yes. Yeah, the NATO side of this is interesting, too. I mean, we do have NATO commitments for all the Baltic countries. I mean, there was great debate as to whether or not NATO should be expanded into these situations, because NATO was set up to keep the Soviet Union from overrunning Belgium or Portugal. And now we're talking about Russian troops possibly going into the eastern part of Estonia, which is something very different. And I'm not sure that the United States should be committed legally to defending in that situation, even if what happens could be characterized as aggression. I think we've put ourselves into a rather difficult position by the expansion of NATO, and certainly the concern about further expansion of NATO, in particular into Ukraine, is something troubling to the Russian government.
So, I mean, how far do you think this can go? I mean, it seems to me that there's a growing brinksmanship here between Russia and America and the West. Are we really going to put ourselves at the brink of going to war over the Ukraine?
No, I don't think so. This is Kim.
I know. Yeah, go ahead, Kim.
I don't think that we're near that. I think that Putin will push as far as he can get away with. And he's very shrewdly calculating how far he can go. I think that, as I said a minute ago, his long-range plan is to keep Ukraine out of the West. And the best way of doing that is to keep things stirred up, keep the eastern part of it completely stirred up, and then see what his options are. At some point, he may use direct force, but he may not even do that. I think just a long-term plan this goes back a long time in Russian history, is if you can't control the core, then make sure the countries on your borders are at least tacitly friendly to you. And that's what I think is being played out here.
So, Robert, one of the things, there's a couple of things here that I wish we had time to get into, which we don't, which we're going to come back another day and just look at the Crimea as well, but that kind of interesting history. I mean, the Crimea was never historically part of the Ukraine until Khrushchev had a fit and did something. But the real question here is kind of the beginnings of this. And I was reading articles in some of the European press in preparation for this conversation that were going back to when Yanukovych was kind of being torn between a European Union loan and a Russian loan.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very interesting piece of the history we don't talk about very much.
Right. Basically, there was this interest, and it was part of the Yanukovych government at that point, in looking at this offer from a closer relationship with Europe, with the EU. But as part of that, and there was some financial elements of assistance to Ukraine that would be part of this, but the International Monetary Fund insisted on some very stern provisions to provide these loan guarantees for Ukraine, which is frankly a basket case when it comes to their economy. So those provisions were considered very harsh, not just by Yanukovych, but even by now the current Prime Minister Yatsenyuk. He's acknowledged how harsh these provisions would be on the Ukrainian people, who are already suffering. They have a very bad economy. Many are extremely poor. There are a handful of oligarchs who kind of control things in Ukraine, and most of the people are very poor. So this idea of making their lives even harder was something that Yanukovych didn't really want to do. And that's when the Russians came in with a much better offer, a $15 billion offer, which had many fewer strings attached. So Yanukovych opted for that approach. And that's what disappointed or angered the people that went into the Maidan, that they felt Yanukovych should have gone ahead with these ties to Europe, which those in Western Ukraine favored, but which people in Eastern Ukraine did not favor. And the feeling was these IMF provisions would have been extremely harsh. And in fact, one of the first things that happened once this new government was put in the last several weeks was the approval of those IMF provisions, which I say, even Prime Minister Yatsenyuk says are political suicide. They're extremely harsh and painful, and he regretted having to do it. But those were the provisions demanded of the European Union.
So I wish we had more. We'll come back to the three of you again, hopefully in the next week, and talk about this more and kind of probe this in greater depth. I think that there's so many complex parts of this and its history and why the Russian populations are in these countries anyway to start with, and the Soviet history and more, that I think we have to understand as we kind of hear where our country is going in terms of its policy. I want to thank you, Robert Perry, Dr. John Quigley. Always great to have you on again. And Dr. Kim Holmes, good to meet you, and thanks for coming on the show today. And look forward to talking to all three of you again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all so much.
Bye.
So that was, thank you all for joining us here today and being part of this program today. Reminding you, on our way out, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community to prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The great Charlie Patton, who passed away, singing under us right now and remembering him, died in 1934, a great early blues man in this country. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Alex Boston. You can hear the show again, podcast the show, and find information about our guests, the work they've been writing, what they do, by visiting us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for public radio, WEAA. 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.
Don't take me long.